Amen. In kids, kindergarten through second grade, if you want to start making your way to the library for your story time. And as they go, we'll be wrapping up our series on the Ten Commandments that we've been looking at all spring, and we've come to commandment number 10, thou shalt not covet. And just to kind of orient ourselves to the text is the way the Ten Commandments are framed, they begin with an orientation of looking to the Lord your God. Yahweh your God is one of the key themes, and it begins, I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And the first, you know, five commandments are to look towards God, what he's done, and have no other gods before you, and don't make graven images, and honor his day, and honor his name. Look to him. And then starting about commandment five-ish, we start to bring our gaze down and start to look out to the world, and it moves from the Lord your God to your neighbor. So these are the frames of relationships that are going to shape your life, and you're meant to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And the temptation we have when we move our gaze down from God out into the world is to begin to look at our neighbor and begin to covet. And just kind of hear the commands and how short. And notice the kind of the linguistic difference with you shall not murder. It's just two quick words. It's sharp. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And now we're thinking about our neighbor. It said, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. So now our gaze is down towards our neighbors, and the temptation of the heart is to start to covet and desire what they have. The Lord has brought us out of a house of bondage. He's going to plant them into their own land flowing with milk and honey, and he's going to give them the good gifts of their own homes and their own places. But once they get there and get settled in, now a new temptation is going to come. So to set this up, I want to do a little thought experiment. So let's imagine that we all kind of get up and joyfully run to the story time with Sam. And we stop by the nursery on the way. And let's imagine we see there in the nursery just this beautiful little girl dressed in Sunday bows. You know, we have two girls, two boys. Cynthia used to joke the difference between the girls and the boys is that you decorate girls. And so she's wonderfully decorated. But you notice that she tires really easily. Has an unnatural kind of pale look. Has a hard time catching her breath, bruises easily. You see little red dots. She begins to cry because her joints are hurting and her lymph nodes are swollen. You know, how would we respond? How would you respond as a parent? I mean, you would instantly like spring into action and begin to search for a diagnosis, and we would rally the prayer team and we would try and help. Those are some of the classic symptoms of leukemia. But now let's imagine we see the same little girl decorated, and her favorite word at this stage in her life is mine, only to be rivaled by no. And she sees a little bunny that somebody else has, and she wants it, tries to snatch it, gets told no, and then begins to cry. So both scenes, we have a little girl's crying. One, we instantly move with compassion for, and the other, you know, how do you respond? Do you kind of roll your eyes? Think, well, kids will be kids. That's no big deal. You know, you kind of look through the world, and a couple years ago, about 10 years ago now, I read an interesting book called The Emperor of All Maladies, and it was a history of cancer. And one of the things they bring out in that book is half of all men and one-third of all women will get cancer in their lifetime. You know, there's 3,500 children a year who get diagnosed with leukemia. So her chances of getting leukemia, you know, slim. But you know what we can say for sure is that 100% of all children, 100% of all men, 100% of all women will have coveting become a cancer to their soul. So I want to use coveting as like the metaphor is that it's like a soul cancer. And the same way you would treat physical cancer, you need to treat this spiritual cancer with the same type of intentionality and aggression, because if you don't, it will destroy your life. That's what it wants to do. So you need to hear the words, you shall not covet. That's why he reiterates over and over, don't covet. And there's a couple different places we're going to look at, but the classic way to go at the cancer is the classic terminology. John Calvin used these two words of mortify and vivify, the way you live the Christian life. And nobody's probably written with more depth on this than the great English theologian John Owen. And if you're going to really grow, he says there's two things you have to do. One is there are certain things that have to be mortified or killed, you know, mortician, mortal. There's things that you need to strangle and they have to die. So there's thoughts, there's affections, and then there's behavior that you have to kill. But then there's also thoughts, affections, and behaviors that you have to cultivate and bring to life. So certain thoughts and dispositions need to be destroyed, and then others need to be cultivated. And if you're going to do war against this soul cancer, you really have to do both. You have to cultivate true love for God and one another, and then you have to kill that soul cancer of what we'll call coveting, or as putrefies into envy. So really what we're going to target this morning is the sin of envy that needs to be isolated and dealt with. And I'll kind of use coveting, envy as similar language this morning. So we're going to kind of move, and let's kind of maintain that medical metaphor. First, all right, what is the disease? Let's look for a diagnosis. What are some of the symptoms? How do you tell if it's there? And then how do you treat it? What's the treatment? So we're going after the soul cancer of coveting or envy. So let's think envy, coveting. All right, what is it? And did you hear, I think Psalm 73 that I read is this beautiful description of kind of what happens to you when you envy. But did you notice, all right, what he says, my feet almost slipped because I was envious of the arrogant. I was envious. And what was he envious of? He was envious of the fact that it seemed like they were untroubled by life. He's like, man, their life just looks like it's so good. It's just Pinterest perfect. Everything is so good and they have no troubles. And then he was envious of their prosperity. He's like, they have no physical pains. They have no pains. They live this wonderful, charmed life. They're all young. They're all good looking and they just have no troubles. And he began to resent the life of another. And so kind of the progression for coveting, it begins when you start to desire the life of another. And then it'll mold and putrefy where you begin to resent them or your own life for their life. And you know, just think, we live in a world where if that smoldering flicker of flame is in your heart, social media just pours gasoline on that desire to desire the life of another. Maybe we can help make some distinctions, maybe the distinction between envy and pity or self-pity. Self-pity is when you ask the question, you know, why me? Why is this happening to me? But it shifts to envy when you ask the question, why not me? Envy is, in essence, you become unhappy because of the happiness of another. You begin to weep when they rejoice, and you rejoice when they weep. A little different from jealousy. Jealousy is where you're trying to guard what's yours. Envy is where you desire what's not yours. You know how you can tell if coveting, you know, the image that God gives to Cain is that sin is lurking at your door. It's crouching and it wants to pounce on you. So the way you can tell, like, this soul cancer is close to you is you can tell by some of the things you say. Like, so kids, you're in danger of coveting when you say things like, that's not fair. Hey, that's not fair. It's not fair. And you often unpack that. You hear that all the time. Like one child will receive one thing and the other children will say, hey, that's not fair. So kids, think about a time when you've looked at the good that someone else has received and thought, well, that's not fair. Or adults, do you know how you know? You know the kind of thing you say when you're being tempted or coveting is lurking. You say things like, must be nice. Oh, the Wilsons are on another vacation. Must be nice. Oh, he gets to work from home this week. Must be nice. Doesn't look like his kids are throwing fits in the bathroom. It must be nice. Envy's alive and well when you look at the good of others and you say, hey, why not me? Why them? Why not me? And you think, all right, what are the things we envy? Did you hear it in the Psalms? I mean, the things he envied was the wealth that someone else had. He was envious of their beauty, envious of their power. Some of the things that we envy are things like talent, skill, knowledge, wisdom, good luck. I'm always intrigued by the things that people envy youth in another, or even people who kind of brag about their youthfulness. It's like you're bragging about the timing of your conception. You had nothing to do with that. And yet we envy those kind of things. So what do we envy? But then here's the kicker. Who do we envy? And this is one of the things in the Old Testament. He's looking, he says, all right, look, don't covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife or his male servant, female servant. This is, in essence, he's established his home and he's got a thriving home economy. Basically, a home business is going well. And don't look longingly at what he has and who he is. Say, man, I wish I had that. But you think about, even in this world, you probably only have a demographic pool of about maybe 10 or 15 other households you would be tempted to envy or covet. Now, we live in a world where, I mean, you could be tempted to covet hundreds of other people. Because if you think about it, you know, we're not often envious of, I don't know, this is kind of one of the odd things about like social media influencers. Because, I mean, you probably aren't envious of like Bill Gates' wealth, but you might be tempted to covet your neighbors. So you think, all right, well, why? Robert Frank wrote a book called Luxury Fever. And in this, his group did a whole bunch of different studies, and what they found is that the vast majority of Americans would rather earn less gross income as long as it meant they were earning more than those around them. So we would rather earn $85,000 a year as long as everyone else around you was earning $75,000 than we would earn $125,000 a year as long as everybody else around us was earning $150,000. So we'd rather earn less as long as it was more than those around us. H.L. Mencken, that great American writer and journalist in the 1930s. So this is kind of the time of depression. He took special delight in the foibles of Americans. And he defined contentment in America, so think 1930. He says, contentment in America is always making $10 a month more than your brother-in-law. And so who are we tempted to envy or covet? It's actually the people closest to us. It's the people you went to high school with. I was with the first time had our 25-year high school reunion this past summer and went. And even getting ready to go, I noticed strange feelings were beginning to well up in my heart that I hadn't felt in a really long time. And I really wanted to be impressive. So I said, Cynthia, you have to come with me. I can't go by myself. But our envy is so dangerous because it turns us on those people who are closest to us. I mean, we're tempted to envy or to covet our neighbor, our friends, our family. And what are the symptoms? Like, what does it do? Is it does four very insidious things. The first, it sneaks up on you. It's so hard to detect. Because even in the kids, I mean, when the kids say, that's not fair, when really what they're saying is, I want what they have, but it's couched in justice language. That's not just. When justice has nothing to do with it, what it is desire. That is not being met. Because they wouldn't say it wasn't fair if they received it. They wouldn't say, no, I don't want an extra cookie because my siblings don't get one. So it's hard to detect. And it can be couched in justice or ambition or goal setting. And you know, it's one of those sins like envy. How many, like if you've been in Christian circles a long time and heard people ask for prayer, I mean, sometimes people openly admit that they struggle with patience. They may struggle with anger or their temper. How many times have you ever heard someone say, "I need you to pray for me, I really struggle with envy"? I mean, it's not often. But I can tell you one thing, especially parents, if you're raising children, especially in this community, one of the top temptations in their heart is going to be that envy captures it. And we have to tell our children over and over, there are just things that others will get that you will not be able to. So envy is lurking. So it sneaks. But then what it's going to do, it wants to steal. You know, your ability to be grateful, it wants to steal your joy. It wants to steal your peace. It wants to steal your contentment, your ability to be thankful and grateful for what you have. And one of the hard things is we live in a society of just systematic envy. You know, it's what fuels marketing, and our economy is almost completely built on consumption and needing more to buy more. And it can fuel a discontent with who you are and what you have. I won't share the findings, but some of you, I've shared this research project a couple times, and it'd be interesting. Maybe this could be a project for the students to update this research. But in 2004, I was a youth minister, and one of the things that was aggravating me is I felt like especially our teenage girls were being oppressed with a false vision of what real beauty was. And so kids, in order to get that, I mean, you got to go back to the Stone Age because there was no like social media. So to know what was going on in the culture, we had these things called magazines, and you had to stand in line at a store, and you could look at the covers of the magazines, and that's how you knew what was happening in the life of all of the rich and famous. So People Magazine, every week on their cover, would tell you about the comings and goings of the important people in the world. And every year they would do, you know, the world's most beautiful person. And in 2004, this was the height of the Friends, you know, Friends. And Jennifer Aniston was named the most beautiful woman in the world. And one of the things that particularly aggravated me about the headline is that she was tagged as, you know, the world's most beautiful woman, and then kind of the first line was hailed her unassuming beauty. It's just unassuming. And one of the lines that drove me crazy was her roll out of bed beauty. See, she just rolls out of bed and poof, here she is. And so we did a little research project to unpack how much she actually spends on this roll out of bed beauty. And this is $2,004, and I didn't bring the itemized list, but if you want it, I can email it to you. But the grand total was $141,000, well, $141.37, so 141,037, period, and 97 cents. So nearly $142,000. Every year on that roll out of bed beauty. And I had the kids do some examining, and so this is 2004, so this is just 20 years ago, so you can tell about inflation. But what could you do with $141,000? And at that time, at least, you could buy almost any home in the community we lived in. You could send your child to nearly any college in the country for 4 years. You could buy 8 Honda Accords, and you could have flown round trip from L.A. to New York in first class 44 times. And all of that for that unassuming roll out of bed beauty. And what I wanted to do is show them, what's being projected to you is not reality. That is not real, so don't desire it. Don't covet it. That is just not reality. And you look at what's happened, like with social, that's 2004, and things have only gotten infinitely more expensive and worse. So what do you do? What it wants to do is it wants to steal from you proper perspective and gratefulness for who you are and what you have. And when it steals, then it begins to sour. It sours your life and sours our world. Think about Vincent Foster, who committed suicide. He was in the Clinton administration, and when he committed suicide, he left a note that ruining people's reputation is sport here in Washington. This envy, it's soured. Or our economy, you think about how many economic crises are fueled by systemic envy. Joseph Epstein wrote a book called Envy, and in it he argues that the 20th century, which was the bloodiest century of all of human history, was one continual cycle fueled by envy. He argues a couple different things. He says, look at Marxism, the glorious revolution. What was it? It was the revolt of the envious, the attempt to eliminate all the conditions for envy, but all it did was eliminate hundreds of millions of people and never got to envy. He argues that the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s, he said, was impersonal general envy, and that freedom of choice is really a veiled desire to live irresponsibly. He says, this is the great plague on humanity. This is a cancer that eats at every human heart, and it won't just sour. Once it gets in you, it shrivels your soul. It makes you critical. It makes you ungrateful. It makes you always finding fault, always looking, and makes you small. So what's the treatment? What's the cure? What do we do about this? And what I want you to notice, and I just was struck in our passage last week for Easter at looking Peter and his restoration, is in this passage you can see pointers to the two things that we need if we're going to strangle out covetousness or envy. One, you have to cultivate real love, and then you have to turn your eye away from envy. Listen to these words in John 21. It says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John. So this is, he's reinstating him. Peter has doubted. He's being brought back, and Jesus is going to really highlight the core sin. And he says, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. And he said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything, and you know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. So the first thing has to be cultivate a love for me, Jesus saying, you love me. And then the way that comes flowing out of you is a care and concern for them, for my sheep. You tend them, you care for them, you love me, so cultivate that. And then Jesus tells Peter, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you're old, you'll stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show him by what kind of death he would glorify God. And after this, he said to him, follow me. So if you're going to deal with, if you're going to kill the coveting first, you have to cultivate a love for him and then follow me. But then notice, as soon as this happens, what does Peter do? It says, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also leaned back against Jesus during the supper, and the one who had said, Lord, who is it that's going to betray you? When people saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? So as soon as he gets restored, and Jesus says, look at me, love me, look up. And as soon as Peter starts looking around, he says, hey, what about him? All right, this is the way my life's going to go. You just said it's going to be hard and difficult, but what about him? Oh, his life is going to be easy. Well, it must be nice to be able to hang out with Jesus and not have to stretch it to die. What about him? And that whataboutism is showing how deep that coveting can live in our heart. Notice what Jesus does, how Jesus reorients him. Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. He says, don't worry about him. I'll take care of him, but I'm talking about you. You follow me. So how does follow me, follow Jesus, become the way we cure this coveting cancer that can eat our soul? You know, we can look, and what does Paul say? Like in 2 Corinthians, he gives a beautiful articulation of this because the Corinthians really struggled with this. I mean, they were very impressed with themselves. And Paul even says, I mean, look at you guys. You have everything. You've become kings, and I wish you'd reign because maybe you could help us out because our life is hard. But they were very impressed with themselves. And what does Paul tell them in 2 Corinthians 5? He says, remember that it's for our sake that he made him who knew no sin to become sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God. And then in 8, it's for you know the grace of God. This is what you know. Now follow in his path. You know that he who was rich became poor, so you who are poor can become rich. And so you know these things, and now you have to live them. You know, look at cancer in the body. There's only 3 ways to get at it. You can cut it out, you can burn it up with radiation, or you can poison it. But you have to be aggressive to go at it. The only way that you can kill the cancer is you have to kill it without killing you. And the only way to get that in, the coveting, the sin out of your heart, is you got to find a way to kill it without killing you. And the path to do that is follow me. He says, you know the grace of our Lord Jesus. And so he died so that the sin in you could die, but you don't have to die. And you got to feel the force of condemned in my place, he stood. You got to feel, all right, it was he was wounded for my transgressions. He was bruised for my iniquities. The chastisement that brings me peace brought him pain. He was broken for my healing. That's what we celebrate every week at the Lord's Supper. This is his body. His body was broken so yours could be back together again. See, envy thrives in your soul when you look at others and say, why not me? Look, why not me? Envy dies in your soul when you look at the cross and you say, why not me? Why not me? That's where I deserve to be. Envy thrives. You're looking up, why not me? Why not me get that car, get that girl, get that home, get that corner office, get to stay home from the office, get that vacation? Live this perfect life, but it dies when you look at the cross and you say, why not me? He lost the ear of God so I can gain it. He was rejected by men so I could be accepted by God. He was falsely accused by worthless men so that when I'm truly accused, I don't have to pay the penalty. He tasted death so I would taste life. You look at the cross and you say, why not me? Because of his mercy. Why not me? Because of his grace. Why not me? Because God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him will not perish. And if I have that gift, I have all and everything I ever need. And everything else is gift. It's all gift. Charles Spurgeon, who was pastor in London during the Industrial Revolution, he was on the South Side, which is a real poor section of London, and he would often go and visit the members of his church, and there was a particular man that he loved to go see because he was one of the poorest people in the congregation, but every time Spurgeon would go, he would go out of his way to try and bring the nicest food he had, and he'd bring kind of stale tea and moldy bread, but then the person would say the prayer and the blessing, and he'd just look at him smiling and he'd say, I have Jesus, and I have all this too. He goes, I have Jesus. And then everything else is all gift. It's all gift. So are you envious this morning? Do you find yourself in danger of desiring the good that your neighbors have or wanting things that you don't have? How can you cut it out? You know, one of the reasons we come to the table, the Lord's Supper, every week is to help us. It reminds us of the spiritual surgical strike to get that sin out. We're reminded that his body was broken so ours could be made whole. We're reminded his blood was shed so we can receive the forgiveness and be renewed and restored. So Lord, we thank you for the gift of your son. We ask that you help us to joyfully, willfully, openly, thankfully, humbly receive that gift. And in receiving that gift, give us, place in our hearts a sense of unbreakable gratitude. And we confess that we live in a land that just seems like everywhere you turn, there's the temptation to fuel covetous desires, to want more and more. And so we ask that you help us. Help us to be transformed by your supernatural grace so we can thank you for what we have and live free from the burden of always desiring more. And this we ask in Christ's holy name. Amen. Here at Trinity, we have four different places where you come to the Lord's table. And this is his table that he opens up to his children to come and to remember his gift of grace. And so there'll be a gluten-free station in the back. And once our servers are in place, you come.